Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
When you do property cosmetic renos in the early part of your life, work shift work. It's the best way to get good money and be able to do a property cosmetic renovation.
This is Property Investory, where we talk to successful property investors to find out more about their stories, mindset, and strategies. I'm Tyrone Shum, and in this episode, we're speaking with successful property investor and owner of Blue Gum Property, David Glover. Join us as we delve into the amazing profits he has made from his properties, the crazy things he discovered when undertaking a cosmetic renovation, and much, much more. Glover starts off by telling us a bit about what he does and what he focuses on in his work.
I own Blue Gum Property, and I've recently been doing more property development and acting as a buyer's agent. But effectively, I believe that I engineer property value. That's what I do. Well, I'm an engineer by profession. I was lucky enough to kick off that way. And so I use property projects are very much a project focused, and being a process engineer, I actually look for how to create value, because at the end of the day, value is what people need, and that's what generates wealth. And if you don't add value to something, then you're really just trading.
On any given day, Glover is engaged in a variety of tasks, including looking after his children and running his businesses.
Oh, it's a combination of a lot. I've got a family. We've got the three kids. So my wife runs her successful business. So a lot of the time I enjoy looking after the family. We've got a number of businesses. I've got a horse adjustment facility as well. We've got the property business. We've got our property portfolio. So I'm very structured in my daily basis with, you know, getting up, heading to the gym, and then, yeah, I've got to get through a little brief bit on email. I'll take care of what's been put down the day before to take care of things. And then, yeah, you've got to have some time where you're actually thinking about where you're headed. And I'll also do some forward planning, as well as keeping on track of where we are with all our projects. Blessed with two girls up, and then Hunter, so spaced around 2 years apart. Now they're in their mid-teen area, and that's been a whole journey in itself. You know, sort of 15 years ago, I was one of the first guys in engineering that I knew that actually went out to, you know, to be the stay-at-home parent, and then move into that phase where you have to learn how to raise a family, manage careers, and and then they evolve through those years, don't they? So you know, when they're younger through to now when they're teenagers, yeah, it's been an interesting journey and evolution of character building too.
Having grown up on a small farm in central New South Wales, Glover delves into his background and upbringing.
My dad worked in a quarry. Actually, it was a cement producing town, and so it was a combination of the small town area. But in that, you know, we had a really strong sporting background in our area. It's quite surprising how good some of our sporting teams were, and we had some dedicated teachers in our area as well. That it was a little mini ecosystem, I suppose. We were very protective. My wife always rips me off that I never saw the ocean till I was 18. But one of those things that, you know, when you grow up, you know, central New South Wales anyway, you don't need to go to the beach every day. You've got, you know, we had Dun Swamp and big, you know, dams where, you know, you go canoeing, and Scouts was a big part of my background as well as football and cricket. And, yeah, a community where it's only 1,000 people, really, you know, a lot of people. We had, you know, like we joke about the old days where you'd get a paper license and you'd walk into the police station and they knew you. So, you know, they had, yeah, you couldn't get away with too much because, but it also, on the other hand, it was really good because it was an ecosystem of lots of different people that knew you and you knew them.
And that's family. That's family, because I think when you have small community, everyone can look out for each other. And also, too, if there's anything that, you know, you can also help out with them, too, you kind of feel that sense of community.
Yeah, I've replicated that now. We live 40K south of Brisbane, you know, smaller community. And it is almost a similar effect. And I love it. I love seeing my kids grow up in an area where they bump into people and they know them, you know, from their sporting teams and all that, right? But when you're in the city, you know, when we're in our unit in town, you rarely get to know anyone outside of, of that unit, basically.
He goes on to tell us more about his high school and what he did after he finished university.
Oh, no, sorry, the central tableland. So, yeah, no, I grew up till I was 17 in Rolleston, Cairns area, and went to the local schools because that's what we all did. Oh, some people went away to boarding school, but we were, you know, small-sized school. I think my high school was 300 people in total. My year 12, there was 24 of us. We knew each other really well. And then, yeah, when at 17 and, off to Newcastle Uni I went. So, headed over there to do engineering. We were at Newcastle, and then, yeah, I got the opportunity after traveling the world with engineering to move into consulting in engineering. And so looked like Shana was with BHP at the time, was going to go to Brisbane. So it was like perfect, right? So I took a consulting role in Brisbane. So I came up, moved in with her dad, and Shana got promoted to Melbourne head office. So I came to Brisbane and Shana was in Melbourne. That was pretty funny.
Hired by a well-known engineering company, Glover got a good head start when it came to his career.
Started working straight away. And about our third year, I got a part-time job with BHP Research, BHP Engineering actually, seconded to BHP Research. So while I was working, there were still the traineeships at the time, but that was finishing up. So they were transitioning it to kind of like part-time work. So both Shana and I were working for different engineering companies. Shana was in a coal operation and I was with BHP Engineering, and it was great. We you get to learn in a organization that's actually doing, you know, projects and stuff while you're at university. That sort of style completed around when we finished. Most companies started moving away from that style. They don't really employ part-time, but we were lucky. We were on that tail curve where you actually worked while you went to uni, and a lot of people did. It was normal.
While working at BHP Engineering, Glover was thrown into a lot of projects, which taught him many new skills. Changes in the industry were also happening at the same time.
We're both chemical engineers, and Shana went on to do a PhD in that, where I got straight into BHP Engineering and was lucky enough to get taught at a really young age how to be a project manager. And we ran lots of, I suppose, smaller but quite interesting projects, and you get your stripes, you know, the hard way. You get thrown into some of the sites and you've got to manage upgrades or some changes. Or at the time, there was a big, very big change in the industry with automation coming in, so robotics coming in, and there was cost pressures. That was back when we had the recession, and they were literally taking out 20% of the workforce at the time. And so you were 20, 21 years old, you know, and you're seeing massive reductions in the workforce, so much so that Newcastle Steelworks shut down. And the smelter where I worked at Tomago, McKinsey just butchered the place. And, so you're seeing guys that had worked for 30 years you know, just getting told to finish up in a, you know, couple of weeks' time. It was an interesting start of my career, let's put it that way.
Glover talks about one of the most important set of skills he learned at BHP Engineering, one which came in handy on his property journey.
The project management skills, which, you know, funny enough, yeah, it teaches you it's a system and a process that you get to clarify, follow, think about. It's been tested hundreds and thousands of times. I mean, I used a system that was obviously developed out of, you know, NASA, you know, so it went on to become what's called the Project Manager's Body of Knowledge, so PMBOK. You get taught very much deeply that in BHP engineering about how to apply project control principles. So you get taught about finances, returns, seeking value, communicating it to other people. That's become a big thing that I do now with my call option contracts, is explaining the value that we're trying to achieve, the intent, bringing in your stakeholders, creating your project plans, creating your budgets, executing the project, and then reviewing the project. So it's a framework of discipline that, yeah, helps one achieve and be able to review and learn.
Whilst working at BHP Engineering, his wife and him saved up to buy a place of their own.
So when we were 21, that's what got us going, Tyrone. I moved in with Shana's mum, actually. 3 months, I lived in their back room. Shana and I saved all our money for 3 months straight. We were 20, and we decided straight away that we were buying a place. And that's what we did. We did that, and lo and behold, we brought a deceased estate when we were literally 21. Yeah, as soon as, yeah. And we were still at uni when we did that.
The purchasing of this property occurred before Glover was in Brisbane and his wife, Shana, moved to Melbourne. And soon after, he purchased another property.
We'd already purchased the property. We got in really early, I suppose. We decided straight away we wanted that property. We had that. We actually, yeah, when we were overseas, we had some mates live there for us and look after it. And then, we came back and we did another property project together. We bought our first farm, a 65-acre property in the vineyards at the Hunter Valley. And it needed a big cleanup, and we built a new house. And it was actually the day I finished laying the flooring in the build of the new house was the day I literally got in the car that night and drove to Brisbane to start work the next day. And yeah, about 2 weeks later, Shana got sent to Melbourne.
Coming up after the break, we'll delve deeper into David Glover's first property.
Shana and I had already completed the cosmetic reno by the time we actually owned the property.
The 65-acre property he invested in that turned out to reap amazing profits.
They transformed this little two-bedroom illegal cottage that had no running water or sewerage into a fully operational house in 2 weeks.
One of the greatest highlights of his property investing journey.
A simple, funny, crazy email had led to that opportunity to sit down with such a legend of the industry over there.
And that's next. I'm Tyrone Shum, and you're listening to Property Investory. In regards to his first property, he goes into detail about the deposit and how he managed to find the property.
We went for our deposit, and back at the time, you didn't get a lot of freebies from the government in a way, right? You did get your waived, but we literally saved $15,000 in 3 months just to top up our deposit. And off we went looking around for what we could basically afford. And, you know, it's the first time I met a buyer's agent. So he was a sales agent, and Jeff showed us one place. And I said, oh, no, Jeff, that's sort of not what we're looking for. And a bit of a chat. And he said, look, come and have a look at this place. And he was a surfy dude from the Cohiba area in Newcastle, you know, near Charlestown. And so he takes us to another agent's property, and he goes, you know, look, this is what I think you could do with this one. And I was like, yeah, you are so right, Jeff. And so funny, my first ever purchase was in effect via he was a sales agent. I suppose buyer's agency in Australia wasn't really well known back then, but he acted as a buyer's agent, and he was brilliant. And yeah, I owe a lot to Jeff. He did a great job. He showed us the property. And, yeah, we brought it. And then it was a deceased estate, unfortunately. It went straight into probate. And we were a little panicked because we were first purchase. And Jeff was great. He sort of said, oh, it's going to probate, which means one of the assets in the whole estate had been disputed. But the house was fine. And he said, look, mate, just go back to them and rent it from them while they're going through probate. It'll only take 5 weeks. And so we negotiated like $5 a week or something, because it was only supposed to be for 6 weeks. But 4 months later, we'd been paying low rent, and Shana and I had already completed the cosmetic reno by the time we actually owned the property.
Glover explains what a probate is, something which played a great role in his first property.
What happened was, if the estate's got a slight issue, so someone's either, wants to have something adjusted in it, or there's problems with some of the paperwork of it, then it's just the process of where they're going through tidying up someone's estate. And so they couldn't complete the sale of the property until that had legally been sorted out with the executors of the estate. So we knew it. There was no risk at the time that the property wasn't going to go through for sale. It was just some background information that was being taken care of by whoever was looking after the estate paperwork.
So it just sounded like a little bit of paper shuffling, which allowed you to have that, say, 6 weeks to do your cosmetic renovation, live there on low rent.
Always look for a deal. When an opportunity comes up, talk and figure out the way forward. And it's surprising.
Doing a cosmetic renovation of his first property was not a pleasant experience.
It was not attractive to our own. Think about this, right? Open up the front door and there's the old toilet seat, right? Now, So it was a pretty bad state, and it smelled like that too, okay? And then there was vertical red, yellow, and yellow, red, yellow wallpaper on horsehair plaster. We took out about 2,500 pot plants from the backyard. Seriously.
Was this like a hoarder's house?
Not quite. I've had worse. But they were hoarders of, pot plants. Let's put it that way. So that was a pretty easy fix in a way. But, good fun. And, nothing was straight in that property. Like, it was, when you're laying tiles and you're wondering why nothing looked square, and for an engineer, and especially my wife, that just drove us nuts, right? So it taught us a lot. And like, even the plaster, I mean, I didn't even know horsehair plaster was a thing. You pull off wallpaper, and I'm ringing up Ray going, Ray, there's like hair hanging out of the plaster. And he just laughed, he'd seen it all before. So he was like, nah, mate, it's all good. So, there was lots to learn. Bamboo wall fittings, it was really, and we ripped up the carpet and there was polished floorboards underneath it. How good was that?
He tells us how much of the work they did themselves and which parts they used outside for help, and gives us some interesting advice when it comes to doing cosmetic renovations.
That was all ourselves, but then I did work night shift at the smelter. So that's when you ran around and you knew all the tradies. So a guy I knew that knew a guy in the one of the other parts of the plant, I ducked down one night shift, and next day he ducked out, cleaned down the roof and painted it for us, all at mate's rates. It was real good fun. Yeah. When you do property cosmetic renos in the early part of your life, work shift work. It's the best way to get good money and be able to do a property cosmetic renovation.
6 weeks later, Glover had to go overseas and had provisions in place when it came to looking after his property while he was gone.
Oh, we got sent to Canada. So Shana and I off we go overseas the next year. So my best mates moved in, and they looked after the place while they were finishing off uni and their early work phase there for the year. So they looked after it while we were away. So it worked out really well. I wish I kept that place. But we sold it because we didn't know any better at the time, and we brought a mortgage foreclosure farm. And that was a whole journey in itself.
Glover recounts the events which happened leading up to him purchasing a mortgage foreclosure farm.
on night shift, Robbie rings up from a mate of mine working down at the cast house, and he goes, "Oh, one of the blokes just mentioned there's a acreage in the, you know, up at the vineyards, right? And it's getting, you know, it's a mortgage foreclosure." And so I rang the agent, and then finished night shift, rode on out on a motorbike, had a look at this farm, met the agent there, and I made the offer, and I said, "Mate, I've got to go to bed, right? I'm working nights." And so I woke up the next day, and he's like, "Yeah, they've banks accepted your, you know, really low offer." And I was like, "Awesome." And so, so we bought a farm.
It's like you come home to your wife and say, "We bought a zoo."
It was like that. She didn't even know. I'd gone out, made the offer, shook hands and said, "Righto, like if it goes through, it goes through. If not..." But he was great. Once again, it's just a matter of, you explain, you know, you offer the right price. You don't try and go too crazy. You try and work with people, not against them. And, you'll often find that you can pick up great opportunities in a flexible fashion.
Adding value to the property happened quite quickly.
It had an illegal house on it. So the guy had built it in the bend of the river thinking that council would never see it. And so I went and saw council and said, "Oh, man," like, you know, and they said, "Yeah, we know about the place." And I said, "Oh, I'm going to build another house on the thing. You're going to be, you know, hung up on it." They're like, "Look, as long as you're going to build a new house, we'll just turn a blind eye, right, for the next couple of weeks, you know, type of stuff." Like, okay, no worries. So Ray and my dad and a few other old blokes, they all came out, and that was unbelievable. They transformed this little two-bedroom illegal cottage that had no running water or sewerage into a fully operational house in 2 weeks. And they were awesome, right? They were just like, how good was that to work with those blokes, you know? And they were all retirees, and yeah, they just dived on in and taught me a lot, because I just wanted to burn it down, put a caravan in the big shed, right? And solution, they're like, no, we're not doing that. And so out they all came and hooked in, and it was amazing what they achieved. And yeah, Dad and I fenced the rest of the property, and we did the right thing. We built a Clarendon big homestead up on the property on a lovely view spot, and yeah, and then life changed. So off we went again.
Do you still have that particular property?
No, wish I did, but geez, we made some good money out of it. Like, that was a huge return, yeah.
The mortgage foreclosure farm ended up reaping a large profit.
I went in at $162,000, $163,000, probably on an acreage that would have been worth, say, $350,000. We built a really big homestead on it, big Clarendon 3-meter verandas. We had it for about 2 to 3 years, and we sold it just shy of $700,000.
That's a phenomenal return. So, definitely. I mean, like, could that place have had other development potential besides building a homestead? Because you said it was acreage, so there's a lot of land there.
Yeah, I was thinking about that, but no, you still wouldn't be able to separate it now. You're still sort of stuck around that 100 acre. And Tyrone, you got to be careful with acreage. It's great for doing cosmetic renos and be smart with, but it's not a thing to, yeah, you want to be careful. Anything that you need to do a zone changing, I think you're best to just wait for it. I had that in Melbourne. When I went down to Melbourne where Shana was, we brought a 5-acre block at Rockbank, and it was in legislation to always be a green zone, but look, it's a suburb now. So when you're at Rockbank train station, I had one, you know, just around the corner. There was an illegal dogfighting place that took 20 skips of rubbish off that property. And, it was in legislation to be green zone. So I was like, oh, it'll never change zoning. So I sold it. And then 2 years later, the zoning changed. And I think it got sold for $2 or $3 million. I was not disappointed. I made really good money. We had a great time there, but it served its purpose. And you learn a few things along the way, don't you?
For Glover, there's one kind of investment that hasn't been successful for him.
Property's great. Shares are shocking with me. I have brought 4 lots of different share companies that have gone broke, like brand name ones, and a couple of them in property, like they were property businesses. And yeah, I have a massively intact record of buying shocking shares.
One of the highlights of Glover's property journey occurred when he made a trip to America with his family.
Sharnak convinced me to head off for basically a 3-month break to America. We took the kids, we lived over there in Arizona, and it was in that time where I went out, you know, you drop emails out, right? It says, oh, Aussie, you know, guy in you know, Phoenix, right? So I went and met about 9 different real estate agents, but the second agent I met was the guy that's basically Mr. Zillow in Arizona, called Randy Courtney. And second guy I met over there, and Randy, if I ever was able to record 2 hours of my life, that would have been the conversation. To sit down with a guy that's got basically a bank account of $700 million to buy properties, and he's buying 100 a month, right, in his office. It was amazing. And at the time, you know, it was great to have a break, get over there, you know, be a tourist, do all that sort of stuff, but, you know, also to think about your business activities, your life, meet people, look at a different system. The American property system is so different to ours. And so I was doing like a study tour and meeting these people and have a look at their Airbnbs and their flips, and then to sit down for 2 hours with Randy Courtney, who was so generous with his time and explained to me all about, you know, Zillow was going into America and how they were preparing for Jeff Bezos to enter the property market there. And I was just stunned that a simple, funny, crazy email had led to that opportunity to sit down with such a legend of the industry over there.
He lets us in on what he wrote in his email subject line that caught Randy Courtney's attention.
I think it was the subject line. It was literally just Aussie guy in Phoenix, right? And that was like the subject line, right? And he'd been to like Melbourne the year before or something, right? And that's what triggered it. He was just like, oh, it's an Aussie guy. Okay, I'll meet him. And they were all like that, because if you're trying to meet people in Australia, they kind of feel like you're a competitor. But I think when you're an Aussie guy in America, they just go, yeah, I'll meet the little Aussie, you know, like this will be interesting, you know. They don't take you as – and they don't have a competitive mindset anyway. Like, they love to help everyone out anyway. They're always making the pie bigger.
From that conversation with Randy Courtney, not only did Glover have a once-in-a-lifetime experience – he learned a great deal as well.
I sat there for 2.5 hours and listened. It was amazing. He told me his whole life story. It was amazing how he built the business, why he's flipped franchises as well in the real estate world, why, you know, Zillow, his own background, his own drivers, his love of sport, his passion there. It was, mindset. Family, we spoke, he's very family orientated as well. So we connected on so many different levels, but I didn't have to say much. I literally was just given 50 years of experience, of his experience, and jammed at me in 2 hours, and I ate it up. It was wonderful. Yeah.
You managed to get photos and reminisce over that moment too?
No, I never got a photo, but we kept in touch since. He sent me links. So when he does these, because he's been going into like vlogs and stuff, right? And so, you know, he's kind of like, oh, you'll send the link and I get to review his, you know, his script and stuff, and I'll send it back and go, oh, you know, why don't you try this, Randy? He's like, oh, good idea. And so he's a guy that he seeks and, you know, searches out people that, you know, he likes and bounces off. And, you know, he's like, you know, late 50s, 60s, and he's still innovative and looking for feedback and, yeah, looking for people to work with, you know. And, yeah, it teaches you a lot, doesn't it?
So, inspired by David Glover's property journey, we'll keep the conversation going in a future episode of Property Investory. We'll discuss his strategy.
We'd identified a great project opportunity and we'd taken a toehold, and then off I went and started to talk to other people about doing a project.
The project that netted him hundreds of thousands of dollars despite unfavorable circumstances.
So we did the DA, and I was so focused on going through to building 14 houses, right? And had my funding lined up and everything.
His great advice when it comes back to giving to society.
Then you've got to stand up every week and you have to basically justify what you've done in the world to make it a better place. You know, not justify, that's the wrong word, but explain to people what you're trying to achieve.
And that's next time in a future episode of Property Investory.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.